The supply chain that feeds our food chain now extends across the country and around the world. Given what we see happening across our country and around the world, we simply must ask, can we bring our food back home?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1359th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Dijon who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with University of California intern producer Vanessa Salas. Hello, Vanessa.
Hey, Michael.
Okay, folks, I just returned from attending Natural Products Expo West in Anaheim, California, which bills itself as having the largest collection of natural, organic, and conscious food available anywhere. It took me 6 hours to hike the 7 or 8 football field-sized exhibition rooms filled with various foods and supplements, and most all of them were available for tasting. And the foodies in attendance were eating away at them with great relish. But I was on a mission and so did not stop to taste many of the foods, maybe only a few. The first was some granola that was infused with Earl Grey tea. I guess the idea was to wake up and get fed in one bite. I don't know. Didn't make much sense to me. My mission at the Natural Foods Expo was to find some natural foods that needed representation in the world. I regret to say that what I did not find many natural foods at the Natural Foods Expo. What I did find were what seemed to be thousands of ultra-processed foods in brightly colored packages. I believe natural foods are the plants one forages or the animals one hunts in nature. Next in line of Michael Olson's natural are real foods grown from real soil by real farmers. Last in line are the ultra-processed foods grown with industrial technologies of energy-intensive agriculture. And they are the foods that come with good intentions in brightly colored packages. Given the supply chain that now feeds this food chain extends across the country and around the world, and given what we see in the news of our country and the world, we simply must pause to ask, can we bring our food back home? And here to help us find some answers, we have Fred Provenza, who is the Professor Emeritus of Behavioral Ecology in the Department of Wildland Resources at Utah State University. He is the author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom. And he is also the author of a piece that I found in the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association titled Nourishing Earth, Nourishing Ourselves, a three-part series that begins with a taste of place. This is the third time we've picked up this piece that you wrote for the Veterinary Journal. And so my first question, Professor Fred, is how did you manage to hide this article in a veterinary journal?
Yeah, good question, Michael, and great overview, too. I couldn't agree more with all that you've said up to this point. In late fall of 2022, I reviewed an article for that journal. And the article was written by professors from the universities here in the U.S., and it had to do with veterinarians getting the word out about climate change to their clients, that they could be influential in raising awareness. And so I reviewed the article and made some suggestions. And the senior editor came back and asked if I would write a perspective paper for the journal. So I said, yes, I'd be happy to. And I wrote that paper. And then she came back and said, you know, I'd really like you to write 3 papers, take each of these subsections of this paper you wrote and develop them into papers. And I said, okay, Shelley, I'm happy to do that. And so, yeah, and it was a great, she was a great lady to work with. And, you know, to try to think of that audience and through her and through interactions with her and what they think about, and then try to write articles that hopefully were relevant. Two of the articles have been published. The third article was just published here this week. So
wow.
The three-part series is done with.
Well, let's tell people what the three parts were. First was A Taste of Place. I just love that title. The second one was Chefs, Diets, Ecological Doctors, Fossil Fuels, and Changing Climates. And the third, I believe, is Locally Adapted Communities as Medicine for an Ailing Planet. What is the thread that ties all of these together?
Yes, good question, Michael. And what I've tried to do, I think, in the articles I write and the many talks I give nowadays, is to start with this idea, and that's where the first paper started, that there's this wisdom of the body that all creatures possess. We appreciate that, I think, whether we think about it overtly or not, that, you know, nobody has to tell bacteria, insect, wild bird, mammal, what to eat, how to reproduce. They, quote, somehow know how to do that, and they're good at it or they wouldn't be here. We've developed, based on 45 years of studies, this appreciation that there is a wisdom of the body that's still alive and well in cattle, sheep, and goats. 10,000 years of domestication did not get rid of that. And then by extension, this idea that, you know, it must still be alive in human beings. Now, it's easy
somewhere
to hijack
buried
that.
Way down
somewhere
deep, right?
Buried deep, yes. And, you know, you started out talking about, and that's a revealing and kind of sad commentary where you have such a big expo and 600,000 people.
60,000.
Oh, 60,000, yeah. Sorry. But it's still a huge number, right?
Huge, yeah.
And that it's mainly ultra-processed food. So, you know, the point then is that our food preferences have been hijacked. I think that occurred in two ways. One is the whole, you know, during our lifetime, yours and mine, the development of ultra-processed foods, and then simultaneously, the way that we grow our foods, the varieties we select for, the conditions under which we grow them, have led to, you know, vegetables and fruits and meat products that may look great on the store shelves, but have very little flavor. You mentioned, you know, you didn't taste a lot of things and so forth at that expo. But so this idea of this wisdom of the body, what is it? How does it work? All the many facets that you and I got into in our first conversation, mm-hmm. is a thread that I've taken all the way through that I've built on. And then, and the first article started out with that. And this made the points that, you know, as regards to domestic animals, the diets that they eat hugely influence their health. But we're coming to realize that the quality of the meat and dairy that comes from those animals to nourish our bodies, that kind of sacred act, really, that's greatly influenced by the diets that they're on too. So that's the thread that we started with in this series. And then the second paper built on that thread, but also got into all these thorny issues nowadays, related to, you know, is meat good for human health? Are meat and dairy good for human health? What are they doing for the environment? And as we discussed, and we know there's all extremes across there from, you know, they're absolutely horrible for human and environmental health. Nothing could be worse. Let's totally get on plant-based diets. To the other extreme, as you move from paleo into keto and then into carnivore diets, where people argue that's really, we need a ruminant revolution, right? All we should be eating is meat. And so... So I talked about that, but I also tried to make a point in there that, you know, people who argue so strongly against livestock often make the case that all they do is degrade landscapes. And certainly they can, and they have done that, But you can make a very strong argument, too, that they can be used to build up landscapes. They can be used as part of a, quote, rewilding programs. And, you know, that, and I use the French shepherds and some of what they do as a way to illustrate that. And then, you know, moved into the third article that was really focused on diet and health and facets related to that, and trying to, you know, to think about communities and local adaptation. What would that even mean nowadays? How would that work? Whether you own a farm or a ranch, what would that mean? What would that mean if what you have is a lawn? You know, that all, quote, all you have is a lawn with grass and so forth. What are ways that we could move toward thinking about natural communities, plant and animal communities, what used to be where we live? For instance, where my wife Sue and I live here in Innis now, which you're familiar with Montana, I know very well, and from our conversations, we have an acre and a half. It's nice to have that. When we bought this place, it was nuked. It was bare soil all over the place. There were a little bit of remnants of some native plants. There was a little lawn that they had put in to try to sell the place, around the place and so forth. So we bought it and we thought, you know, let's just encourage the native plant species here. Let's work with that. We like to grow plants ourselves. So we put in vegetable gardens, which we've been doing forever. Right. We did it with deep beds, because the soil is so rocky here, it's simply a rock pile. So we put in vegetable, we put in herbal, we put in medicinal gardens, we put in a greenhouse because the climate's harsh here to get stuff started early, to grow tomatoes and things like that. We put in a little chicken coop and raise some chickens. So we don't have a big piece of ground, but we can be little farmers and ranchers, so to speak, you know. And if you can grow your own food and you can have those fresh, grow good varieties, and you have that fresh, nutritious, delicious food, it's, you know, that's putting you back in touch with nourishment, yeah, with life. And I'll make one other comment, and I'll let you, I've been long-winded here.
Okay.
But, you know, when you get the native plants started, it's amazing the diversity of different species of native grasses.
You know what, Fred? I think that's something I'd like to pick up, because
okay,
Vanessa is working that subject right now, too. So let's pick up native plants when we get back from this break. Folks, this
okay.
is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, with Vanessa Salas, producer, and Professor Fred Provenza.
Now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
We are back. Michael Olson here with Fred Provenza and Vanessa Salas. Vanessa is our intern producer here at Food Chain Radio, and you're working on a show about native plants and growing food that we can eat.
Yeah, as an agroecology major, like, I'm understanding how important it is to eat local and incorporate native plants in landscapes.
Very good. And Fred just brought up the notion of native plants in landscapes. Fred, take it away.
Vanessa, I'm thrilled to hear that you're doing that and thinking about that seriously. I my mother had always raised plants. She loved gardens and growing beautiful, you know, domesticated plants and so forth. But I often say I'd never really seen a plant until I took taxonomy my sophomore year in college. And it blew me away for so many reasons. One, we had to study a whole book just to learn how to go through these horrible dichotomous keys to key out all these plants. Now you can use an app and photograph and stuff, but in those days it didn't exist. So you had to go through these dichotomous keys that laboriously talked about all the plant parts and so forth. But it was good. It was a good discipline. But we had to collect 50 plants and turn them in as part of the class. And I just fell in love with plants. I could not believe it. And when I went back home that summer to work on the ranch, I remember a favorite little stream I used to like to fish, and I couldn't even walk up that stream because I couldn't quit looking at all the different plants and saying, oh, yeah, I think that's it. It makes you think, you know, how all these worlds within worlds within worlds that we never even see them. And so, you know, here in our little place, all the grass species, cool season, as people call cool season and warm season. Cool season gets started early in the spring, warm season more in the summer. But the different grass species that are here, so cool. Blue bunch wheatgrass, buffalo grass, different wheatgrasses and so forth. And when you come to know them, you it's like a friend, huh? You go, oh, yeah, I recognize you. And then the forbs. One of the first things to green up is a plant called local weed. And it's all over starting to green up. And once it produces its leaves and it produces beautiful white flowers, and then there's larkspur and on and on. And then all the different shrub species that as we go into the summer. And one of the plants that I'm thinking of too, flax is another one. But well, the point I want to make is that when people walk down the road here and they see all those plants blooming, it blows them away. They say, oh, your yard is so beautiful. What you do? And we say, well, we just encourage the native plant species. You know what I mean? And so I think that's fabulous what you're doing, Vanessa. And I think trying to encourage people to think about that, to think about that as a low-cost way environmentally. When you look at the amount of lawn that's grown here in the U.S., it's the size of Texas. When you look at the amount of fossil fuel to irrigate that lawn, to mow those lawns, the amount of water out here in the arid west that we use to irrigate, and the amount of herbicides we use to keep it just a monoculture, right? The nature abhors that, actually. And the amount of pesticides we use, it's incredible. I'm thinking of a study that was just published last year about the iconic lawns that they grew in Cambridge.
Those great ornamental lawns.
Yes, yeah. Planted like in the late 1700s at King's College. And these people decided to do a study where they planted a diversity of different forbs in there, flowering plants. And then they looked at what's the carbon footprint of the lawn versus the plants. And they looked at the diversity of the diversity of animal species went way up when they had diversity of plant species. The carbon footprint went way down because they're not irrigating and fertilizing and cutting those lawns. And the cost, the monetary cost went way down. So it's like, well, nature's way is the low cost solution to vegetating landscapes, you know, and we can all do that.
You know, Fred, you taking you back a little bit here to your three-part article that was published in the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association Journal.
That's a mouthful.
It was a mouthful. And you know what I really appreciate is the fact that somebody's looking at nutrition through the eyes of animals. And one of the things that you started off your piece with was how mothers in the animal kingdom wander across the landscape and eat those things that they know are what they should be eating at that time for various purposes. And they transmit that knowledge to the fetuses in their body. Child to be, this is what we should be eating now. And the child learns what to eat right there in her mother's womb. And so you made the point that, by golly, we all have that native knowledge of what to eat and what not to eat by virtue of our mothers. I'm hoping that they're not all eating natural foods like I saw this past weekend, please. But they're eating good food, and those good foods, you know, become part of our knowledge. But somehow we're being robbed of that innate knowledge given us by our mothers. And it seems like, I hate to point the fingers, but it seems like, who's doing this to us? Who's stealing our knowledge?
Yeah, it's such a key point, Michael, and I'll put some ideas out related to who's stealing that knowledge. Let me make another point that that fits absolutely with what you're saying. You know, these transgenerational linkages that we've broken them in ourselves, we've broken them in the animals in our care too. We've broken our kind of coevolutionary linkages with landscapes. And you can see, as you said, you know, so mothers passing on this knowledge, and mother got her knowledge from her mother and so forth and so on. And so if you're co-evolving with the landscapes, you really do become in sync throughout the year with what's nature offers, with what you need and so forth. And so it's long-term kind of coevolution and co-creation within those communities. And we've really lost all of that. I think two things happen simultaneously. And Mark Schachter does a great job in his book, The Dorito Effect, of talking about these two things. One is that, the flavors of wholesome foods, fruits, vegetables, meats, and so forth, have become really bland during our lifetime. During the last 50, 75 years, it's just gotten very bland because of the varieties we've selected for, the ways that we've grown them. We pick them green and ripen them in transit. And so, you know, they look great on the store shelf, but they have no flavor whatsoever. And as we talked in that first installment, that flavor is linked with the nutritional quality of the food. That our liking for the flavors of food is being mediated by feedback. Here's some mouthfuls, by metabolic feedbacks from cells and organ systems. You know, when we think about why we eat, we're nourishing those cells. And so, you know, these foods look good, but they have no flavor. And that's the body saying, you know, don't waste my time with this, because there's nothing here. There's nothing here that's worthwhile. So that was one, you know, that's a horrible thing that happened. This emphasis on quantity as opposed to nutritional quality. And I think if we can move back to more local and fresh and thinking about what is it we're trying to do with food, we're trying to nourish ourselves and the landscapes we inhabit. So, you know, getting back to wholesome, nutrient dense, rich foods, I think is really important. So that was happening. But then at the same time, the food industry was figuring out how to hijack our preferences. You know, you follow flavor with a blast of energy from refined carbs. And, you know, that's a common element in all these ultra-processed foods. You've got these very highly sugar-laden, carbohydrate-laden flours and those kind of things that are very quickly digested to glucose. You get this blast of energy of glucose that's very reinforcing. And so we love those foods. They're just, you literally can't resist them. It's like the Dorito ad back when I was a kid. Nobody can eat just one. And it's a fact. And so those things happen simultaneously. And I think we started moving down this path that we didn't even realize what was happening. And now I just finished reading a book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind. It was written by a psychiatrist who moved away, to her credit, from drugs to try to deal with all these mental health issues that we're confronting nowadays. She said, you know, for her at least and her colleagues, it just wasn't working. We're not curing people. We're not helping. So she started moving into diet. And the book is really about how, by eating, as you said, and are promoting on this program, eating wholesome foods, and watching what you do with that to try to get back to diets that are healthy for you metabolically, mm-hmm. in terms of glucose, insulin, obesity.
What was
issues.
The name of that book?
Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind.
Oh, love it.
Yeah, it's a good book, and she would be an interesting one. Have a look at it. You and Vanessa, have a look at the book, and she might be an interesting person for you to interview. I really appreciate what she's saying, and I appreciate this when she gets more. So she's really getting into some of the anatomy and physiology of how this works. But she does it in ways that aren't overwhelming, I don't think, for an average reader. And she has great illustrations. But then as she gets into the diet part, she's not trying to tell you, Michael, you need to eat a carnivore diet, or you need to eat a keto diet, or you even need to eat a paleo diet. She's saying that get away from the ultra-processed foods, for one, because they're not good for us, and two, then start to figure out for your body. She doesn't talk about the wisdom of the body, but it's very much related to that. Figure out what works for your body and what causes. I'm amazed at all the food sensitivities nowadays that people have.
That
she talks, oh my gosh, and food allergies, and you think, my goodness, this is terrible. So she tries to help people to figure out how can you move toward wholesome foods and somewhere along that range from paleo to carnivore. But she's not dogmatic about those things.
Which is something you
experiment with your body.
That's something you do a very good job of laying out in your work. You talked about the subversion of our tastes. One of the other few things I tasted at the Natural Food Expos was a jelly. That's what people are making food in now. I think it all stems from gummy bears. And then cannabis industry got really big into gummy bear things. So you take a nutrient or a taste or something and you inject it into these gummy bears. And that's people food now. I think of it as city food. Somebody handed me a packet of these and I looked at it and it said elderberry. So evidently what they did is they took juice from elderberry, put it into these gummies, and then sweetened it with high fructose corn syrup.
There you go.
And so you can pop these gummies and have a hit of elderberry taste, and you get a boost from the sugar, and away you go. And it's kind of, I don't know.
It's fabulous what you just said, Michael, because that's summing it up. That's another way to say what I'm saying, and very nice. That's exactly what happens. You get that blast of energy in there. The other thing, too, that I've always taken issue with, and I'll just throw it out here, the more we so much go towards single-factor kinds of thinking, and so, not just elderberry, but what's the compound in elderberry that's going to be healthy for you?
So we'll extract that out.
We'll extract it and purify it, and we'll hit you with resveratrol or any of the number. But it misses the point. I think one of the best articles I read when I was writing Nourishment in the Human Nutrition was titled Food, not nutrient, is the basic unit in nutrition. And it was such a good article because they were saying, foods are incredibly, incredibly complex. And when you try to isolate and purify individual compounds, you're missing the point. The body is responding and benefiting from these literally tens of thousands of compounds that are in the wholesome foods that we eat in a meal. And we study something like, 130, I think. Don't quote me on that exact number. 130 nutrients that people have looked at. There's tens of thousands of these compounds in plants. Meat alone has 45,000. A body knows what to do with that, but it overwhelms our ability science-wise to... reductionist science simply isn't set up to study one compound at a time, let alone...
Only God really knows. Only
right.
God and your body really knows
right.
which you need. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Mike Lolson with Professor Fred Provenza, and we have Vanessa Salas, who's produced this show, and we will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, we are back. This is the Food Chain, Michael Olson, with Vanessa Salas and Professor Fred Provenza. We're talking about food. Fred, who is the author of so many things, Nourishing Earth, Nourishing Ourselves, is a piece we're talking about today that he wrote, three-part piece for the Journal of American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association. And he talks about the relationship of our taste with our world. And lo and behold, makes the essential argument that we are taught what is good for our body from the get-go by our mothers. And when we're in the womb, she's eating things that she believes her body needs, and we learn from her. And from there comes our taste. And how that taste gets subverted along the lines by those who want to make money with us, with our tastes. And so how do we come to grips with the fact that people want to make money from us? You made mention, Fred, of the fact that businesses tend to take an element from a complex thing like food and put it on the table and say, this is really significant. And I saw a lot of that at Natural Foods Products West in Anaheim. I would walk along and I would see a sign that would say resveratrol. Oh, what is that? And is it natural to be able to have a chunk of resveratrol? I don't think so. It would probably come in a food of some kind. But that's not what they're saying. They're saying that resveratrol is the thing that you want to get. So, and when it gets right down to it, like you mentioned, there are elements that we look at. 126, I think you mentioned. And no, we do not know if we're going to be feeding a plant which of those 126 nutrients they need. So when we synthesize those nutrients into a solution and feed them what we think they need, it probably is really not what they need. Does that make sense?
Yes, yeah.
And so when you grow your garden, you don't feed your plants single element nutrients like nitrogen, do you?
No, absolutely. Absolutely not.
And we don't feed our bodies single element nutrients either. So I'm of the opinion that every body, not just some bodies, nor some body, everybody, regardless of who the tenant who happens to reside therein happens to be, everybody has the same elemental desire to grow up to be healthy, smart, and strong. And the only way the body can get to that place is that if it is given access to all of the essential nutrients in an available form. And I don't think any manufacturer of food ever touts the fact that they're offering that in their food. Or at least I didn't see it at Natural Food Products.
Right.
So how do we get all of those essential nutrients in our food?
Yeah, I think that's the question nowadays, is how do you do that? How, given that many of the plant and animal products, plant products, I would think in particular, are not necessarily so nutritious. I'm thinking, you know, I was on a webinar here a week or so ago in Canada, and there was a lady from the Bionutrient Food Association, Dan Kittredge and his group of folks. Shauna was the lady who was giving a wonderful presentation. And the point that they're making is the tremendous variation in nutritional quality, whatever nutrients you want to look at when you go from farm to farm to farm. You know, we often will argue nowadays, or some will argue that, you know, certain kinds of production practices lead to more nutritious foods. And I get what people are wanting to say and wanting to do with that. But what they're finding, and what extensive literature reviews in the scientific literature are finding when they review whole bunches of studies, is that no one form of production, whether that's conventional or organic or real organic or biodynamic or regenerative or on and on and on, has a lock on nutritional quality of their soils or of the foods that they're producing. You just see this tremendous variation. So the take home message that I get out of that is that each farmer, each person, for Sue and I too, it's up to you to figure out how to create the plant communities and the healthy soil that you need to actually produce the wholesome foods. It's amazing to see that. It takes me back, Michael, to the many, many years when we were working with cattle, sheep, and goats and so forth, and realizing the same plant species can differ so much chemically depending upon the environment where it's growing. So you can take a plant, I'm just thinking one like bitterbrush, it doesn't matter, or Sericea or any of them, and it can be growing under one set of environmental circumstances, and animals will love it. They'll love to eat it. Put it in a different environment, and it's so different chemically, they avoid it. They strongly avoid it. So, you know, I hope that's making sense. But
sure, because it's all in the inherent taste.
Yeah, and in the environment where that plant's growing. And so as a farmer or a vegetable grower or a rancher or whatever it is, you know, a person really has to start thinking about, you know, what environment am I growing these plants in terms of the moisture and the nutrients and so forth? And is it yielding food that's of really high nutritional quality or not? That's just such a key point. So then a person starts to think about, well, you know, I think the best is if people can grow some of their own food, just to put them back in touch with life, as you say. That's a grounding and centering kind of thing. And then you'll figure out how to, if you're getting things that aren't good, you'll figure out how to increase fertility. It's a process, but you'll figure out how to get your soils to where the foods that come off of that are delicious. The other thing you can do, if you can't do that, is to think about who do we know locally that we can source food from.
I think of it as food with its farmer's face on it.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And we can all do that. Sue and I, for most of our life, have been able to raise our own, raise lambs, raise a steer. We can't right now at this place we're at. We'd like to get a few lambs, but the covenants right at the moment anyway aren't allowing that. But you know, if you can't raise your own, think about the food with the face. And you know, we get our beef from close friends. In fact, they're coming to spend the night with us tomorrow night, and we know how.
You can put those steaks on the grill, and you can take them off the grill and put them on your plate. And in your mind, you can see the farmer who grew that steak.
Yes, and you have a relationship with that farmer. You know, last year, I'll give you an example here, too. Last year, Sue and I hosted a family reunion up here in Innes. We wanted to get my four sisters and their spouses and kids and stuff. We had a big bunch of people. But on the 4th of July, We cooked steaks from Francois and Kate. They're the people that we source our meat from. We didn't tell these, you know, all my relatives anything about the meat, nothing. We said not a word. We cooked them nicely on the grill. And I'm telling you, they raved about that meat. They raved and raved and raved. There wasn't a steak left. And, you know, these aren't like hardcore carnivores. They raved. They said, where did you get it? We'd love to get meat from this person and so forth. And that's, you know, that's all that we've been talking about on this program. Francois, appreciating the importance of plant diversity for the diets of animals, finishing those animals on these diverse pastures, slaughtering them in ways that appreciate their sentience and stuff, you know, and treating them in ways right up to the moment of death. And you know, as you know, Michael, and I do too, you know, how animals are treated influences the level of stress in their bodies, the level of cortisol. There's a lot been written about, quote, dark cutters, which is what happens to the meat when animals are treated poorly during the last the days of their life and when they're slaughtered not in humane ways. All those things really influence the quality of the food. Then we offer carrots that came out of the garden, tomatoes that were coming out of the greenhouse, and people were raving about that. And we weren't trying to make a big deal, nothing. But what it tells me is that taste is a way to get people to wake up to this whole thing. You know, I mean, I could maybe talk about all the details of all this kind of stuff, and people might shake their heads and say, yeah, I kind of get it. But when they get blasted in their palate with something that's so delicious and so different from what they're used to eating, they get it, you know, and then that's the way to open the conversation, right? And then you say, by the way, and then you can go as deep as a person wants to go in terms of, you know, this stuff is really good for your body. It's good for your brain, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, a bunch of detail that for me, I find fascinating of how all this works. But in the end, it's like you say, it's the miracle of the wisdom of the body to know what it needs and to know when it's trying to be duped when it comes to wholesome foods. Unfortunately, the food industry has really figured out. You know, I may have mentioned, Michael, earlier, I used to attend conferences and participate with people from the human food industry, although our work was mainly with cattle, sheep, goats, bison, elk, those kind of creatures, wild and domestic. But it was amazing to me to be involved in those workshops and stuff where we'd be presenting information to one another, because we were all talking about the same principles and processes about how all this stuff works. But boy, they were figuring out, how do we use that knowledge now to get people hooked on our products? And you summed it up with the gummy bear. Mark Costner summed it up in the Dorito effect. And, you know, so it's led to a food industry that's really overall hijacked our food preferences. And then you have the medical industry and the pharmaceutical industries that create products to try to help us with all these adverse effects, where, as I mentioned on Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, that lady gets it in terms of, you know, get off the, for the most part, probably forget the drugs, get on wholesome foods and see where that takes you. And it's probably going to take you where you need to go in terms of health. And there's another medical doctor I work with. We often have very early morning conversations. And his whole approach is that, you know, we're going to first change your diet. We're going to get you on wholesome foods. And then if you've still got issues, he hasn't thrown the baby out with the bathwater in terms of Western medicine, but first we're going to get you on a really wholesome diet. And then we'll see and in most of these cases, there's nothing else that needs to be done. And that's the argument that's being made in Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind.
And also in your work, Nourishing Earth, Nourishing Ourselves, you know, the essential core problem that each and every one of us face. It's a vexing problem that we have to face every day of our lives, and that is how to get the essential nutrients we need into our body. How do we make them available? Where do we find them? And everything in industry seems to be trying its best to subvert our attention to other things. And what you point out about putting all of those easy fixes down, the jellies, putting them down and finding real wholesome food is perhaps the only answer. So, Fred Provenza, we have 1 minute left. Do you have any closing thoughts for us poor people out here who are eating gummies and granola infused with Earl Grey tea? What are we going to do?
Michael, do you remember this old fitness guru named Jack LaLanne?
Oh, of course, yes.
Do you remember Jack LaLanne? He understood back then. He said, if man made it, don't eat it. It's as simple as that. If man made it, don't eat it. You know, my wife and I, as we journeyed over time on all this stuff, what we've decided is that you simply cannot bring that stuff home. When you go to the grocery store, I know this takes time to prepare meals and stuff, but when you go to the grocery store, only put wholesome foods in your basket. If you bring home the processed foods, you can't resist it. And Sue and I can't even resist it. When people bring that stuff over, if it's around, we'll eat it. So what Sue does, she takes it the minute it comes here. We're very grateful for people who bring it. She throws it in the trash because you can't.
It's just hard.
What you put that in front of you on the table, I'll eat it. I admit it. So that's the way that we do it. We just avoid having. And Jack's advice: if man made it, don't eat it. And then you got to do the work to try to figure out where do you source wholesome fruits, vegetables, meats, those kind of things. You got to do the work. And sure, as we've been saying, and you promote. You know, if you can grow some of that yourself, it'll put you back in touch with life. It'll ground, it can ground and center you.
Fred Provenza, Emeritus Professor of Behavioral Ecology at Utah State University and the author of Nourishment, What Animals Can Teach Us About Rediscovering Our Nutritional Wisdom.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.